Hello, friends. Shelley here with a very quick apology for what you're about to hear today. Wait, no. The episode is great. It's just my track has some static and popping on it because as longtime listeners will remember, I got some new equipment in May to solve a problem with an old mixer. Well, the new equipment died, and I'm temporarily using the old mixer while we wait for a replacement for the new thing. And I thought I had at least temporarily sorted out the difficulties with the mixer, but apparently not. So you'll hear a little weird noise on my track today. It's not unlistenable, but it's not perfect. And we go for perfection here on LTS because we love our listeners and we want everything to sound its best. So here's the thing. We've already recorded the next episode and it sounds perfect. So fear not, this is a one-time or occasional time thing. On with the show. It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm your host, Shelley Brisbane. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 65. Today we're talking about The Manchurian Candidate, John Frankenheimer's thriller from 1962, starring Lawrence Harvey, Frank Sinatra, and Angela Lansbury. And I have to tell the story at the beginning because initially this was going to be one of the busiest, biggest roundtables of LTS participants ever. But no shade on the person who's left, but we're down to two. It's just me and David Jaylor. David, hello.
Herb Tarlick is a hard worker, a loyal husband, and an all-around fine person.
Damn right he is. Thanks for being here, David. Thanks for being the one who clicked the link at the right time today. Well, I'm shading all of my panelists who I'm not identifying. They're all lovely. They're all the bravest, the kindest, the warmest human beings.
They are wonderful people. Yes, they are.
But they're off playing solitaire somewhere all by themselves. All right, let's get all the Manchurian Candidate jokes out of the way. No, wait,
oh,
we can't. Just
no.
Do that through the course of the movie. Well, David, I always ask, and this is going to be the most David and Shelley show ever, which if you've listened to any incomparable shows, is probably reason for you to turn it off right now. But we're going to have fun anyway. And David, I'm going to ask you what I always ask everybody, but I know the answer to this one. David, ever seen Manchurian Candidate before?
I have actually seen this one before. Go figure.
Go figure.
it's one of those movies that, you know, growing up, I had heard about it a lot. My grandparents loved it. My mother loved it. But it was out of circulation for whatever reason. There are apocryphal stories as to why. But, you know, either way, it was not one of those movies that showed up on Channel 44, WTOG, Tampa, St. Petersburg, which is where I got all my old movies as a child. And, you know, it was just a thing that you had heard about. It was like this almost non-existent classic movie. And when there was the whole the groundswell of, you know, when the studio got the rights back and then they're like, oh, we're gonna do the big re-release in like 1988 or 89 or whatever it was. And I was just like, I wanna see this movie. And I have seen it probably 10 or 12 times since then because it's just so good.
It is really good. And I, just to sort of let people know what the rumor mill has always said, so Frank Sinatra was a producer of the movie. He was also a supporter of John F. Kennedy when he ran for president. This movie was released in 1962. And the rumor is that when Kennedy was assassinated, the movie was removed from distribution at Frank Sinatra's request. It did get removed from distribution, but it was actually a flop when it was released. And so I don't know whether a year and a half later it would have been out in the theaters in any case, probably not. And so it comes back in something like 1987. And so the disputed part is whether Sinatra really had a role in it, or it could have been a money dispute because I think he didn't feel it was distributed by United Artists. And there was some question as to whether they were handling the money correctly and sending it to where it should have gone. But I first saw it in a theater. And that's so lovely to have seen this thing for the first time on a big screen. It was probably in the late 80s. I'm not certain. I'm pretty sure that they probably did a round of distribution in art house theaters, university theaters, that sort of thing, when it was re-released. And I was, you know, first in line kind of a thing.
Right, right.
And I've probably seen it three or four times, maybe not as many as you, but seeing in the theater, especially when we get to the last scene that's so cinematic, was just very, very striking. And so I always encourage people, if you really love a older movie, make sure you can see it in the theater. And this is definitely one of those. Although this is, as an older movie, it's 1962, which is kind of late for Lions, Towers, and Shields, to be honest. But I don't care because we started talking about this, I guess, when Angela Lansbury died, although it came up a little earlier when you, David, and I, and Philip Michaels, and some other folks from The Incomparable were on Old Movie Club, and we talked about 7 Days in May, another John Frankenheimer movie. And I think at that point, all of us agreed, yeah, we should probably talk about Manchurian Candidate.
Yeah.
So it's been percolating around the ether.
And it is 60 years old. It's black and white. It's fine. It's fine.
It's modern in style. It's like,
it really is.
It doesn't feel, which is sort of the point I was going to make before I got myself off track, was just that it feels more modern even than movies that were made a couple of years earlier, probably also because it's a thriller. Like if you think about comedies, they date much more quickly anyway. But just from a stylistic perspective, this is has got a lot of modern. It's very watchable to modern audiences, I think.
It doesn't feel like a movie even from 1962. And part of it is the plot. I mean, the plot of it and the satire of it is still applicable today, sadly, you know, at least on a surface level. But a lot of the techniques are fascinating. There is a whole intercut sequence in the beginning, which I mean, we'll get to when we get to like actually talking about it, but it reminds me of things I've seen from later in the 60s that maybe they saw this and were influenced by it, or, you know, it managed to influence enough people. But it's the whole brainwashing sequence that feels like something out of The Prisoner or The Avengers or I Spy. There are all kinds of tropes that we recognize from old movies, like using newspapers for exposition, but they're so artfully done. There's no one scene of a person sitting down, you know, snapping a newspaper open and holding it in front of the camera. It's all really subtly. You have to look for them, but they're there. It's all, there's a lot of subliminal exposition in this movie, which is just so brilliantly done.
Yeah, and it's especially noteworthy because, and this one of the two Oscars it was nominated for was editing. And what's so interesting about the editing is a lot of times when it switches from scene to scene, that's even very subtle. It's not like we're going to do a big dissolve or you quickly move from one place to another. So the editing is, I mean, there are a couple places where when there's action, especially the end, where there's sort of a different style. But the way this movie moves, especially considering that there are flashbacks in it, is really unusual for a movie of the sort of classic era. And you're right, those newspapers, I hadn't thought about it quite that way, but you're right. When they show the newspapers or when there's visual stuff that indicates exposition, it doesn't sit there on the screen for 10 seconds and give you time to read it, or as in the old Warner Brothers movies, dun, 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 and then they show the headline and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's no spinning newspapers flying at the camera. It's like a newspaper over the back of a chair upside down, but your brain processes it.
Well, a detail I hadn't seen, just because we're talking about visual stuff, that I did not see, but I saw when I was reading about it today, is in the brainwashing scene early on when you have one of the soldiers. Actually, no, it's not in the brainwash. I believe it's in the bar scene or first before that. You have a soldier reading a magazine, and there's a picture of Janet Leigh on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed that one before.
It's a really nice touch.
So John Frankenheimer goes on to do 7 Days in May, which is another political thriller, and Seconds, which I think probably when we talked on the Old Movie Club about 7 Days in May, I think that one came up a little bit. But Frankenheimer's a TV director, which is kind of interesting. And I don't know a lot of his TV work, but I kind of wonder if that infused the way, not that this looks like television at all, it absolutely looks cinematic, but I kind of wonder if some of the subtlety about it infuses the way he directed this.
And it certainly makes all the sequences that are set on television in scenes, it makes them look right. This is one of the few films from that era where that's really what TV looked like. It's kind of impressive.
Yeah, actually, and I particularly when late in the movie we see the TV images of the convention.
Right.
That it looked like what if you went to YouTube and you went to look at the 1960 or 64 political conventions, which you can do, by the way. And if you want to see Herbert Hoover right before he dies in 1964 at the Republican convention, you can see that on YouTube. But it looks exactly like this. It's washed out. It's black. It's not only black and white. It's really washed out because you have low quality, small televisions. And so it absolutely does look real. And the TV is very much present. It's a part of life, but it's also not, and this is something that I find in modern movies that I'm annoyed by, is when it's like, look, we have technology. Let's use technology all the time. Maybe just because it's Apple TV I'm thinking of. It's like, look, we have iMessages. But TV is very much in context and also is, like I say, in that latter scene where they're watching the convention, it's useful because they're getting information from what's going on at the convention while they're watching television, but they don't overdo it.
Oh, just the way exposition is ladled out in this movie is amazing. Even right up in the beginning, when Raymond Shaw is coming home from Korea, and just that scene at the airport as he's getting off the plane and he's met by people, and you learn immediately who his parents are, how he feels about them, who each of his parents are and what they're doing and how they're, you know, famous. And it's all done with this deft touch. There's no like, hi, I am I'm Raymond's stepfather. Hi, I am his mother. You know, it's really subtle.
Yeah, I think the only time that falls apart is later on in the scene where he and Frank Sinatra are, when he's drunk with Frank Sinatra and there's the exposition about his girlfriend and all that. And then it's like, oh, we're doing exposition. And my thought always in a movie like this is, oh, we're going to need that in a minute, aren't we? And yes, we do.
That is maybe the weakest moment in the movie.
Yeah, even though I enjoy Lawrence Harvey playing drunk, given a character that is as laconic as he is throughout the movie, for him that was probably a fun scene to do, if only because you got to have a little bit of emotion, a little bit of personality, because he doesn't in the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Well, let's sort of run through not necessarily detailed plot, because that's not what we do on Lions, Towers, and Shields, but we'll we'll go through it to some extent. So we have Raymond Shaw, who is Korean War, who we begin in Korea. He's the sergeant of this platoon, and his platoon is in a bar, and it becomes clear that they don't like him because he wants them to stop playing around with the girls and go to sleep, and they clearly don't have any respect for him, which is going to become relevant quickly later, because every time anybody refers to Raymond Shaw later on, it is that he is the warmest, kindest, bravest human being ever, and clearly nobody likes him. That they're not subtle about how nobody likes Raymond Shaw. And as I say, he's very laconic. I didn't think of him as unlikable. I just thought of him as pathetic and pretty miserable, that guy. And then we see them out on patrol, Raymond Shaw, who is the sergeant, and Frank Sinatra, who is his commanding officer, and the other people in the patrol. And they are captured and taken away to a garden party, which is what happens when you get captured in war, right?
Yeah. Well, and they're captured and they're taken away, and suddenly we have opening credits. And you're like,
yes.
Huh. And when the opening credits end, suddenly we have the voice of Paul Frees, and he's narrating, and he's narrating so seriously.
Oh boy, is he narrating.
He's, you know, as much as I love this movie, that is one of the moments that takes me out of it now, because he sounds exactly like he does on Stan Freberg's The History of the United States of America Part 1, which is a very funny album, and go and listen to it. Don't listen to the second album. He did it like 30 years later. Nowhere near as good. But Paul Frees is delightful on that. And so I keep wanting these comedy songs to break in as he's narrating. But he gives us this narration of, you know, suddenly Raymond Shaw is some kind of hero because he saved his platoon and they took a gun embankment and, you know, all this stuff. And you're watching it kind of going, wait a second, we didn't see any of that. That didn't happen, did it? And it turns out it didn't happen.
Turns out. And we get this weird, and it's this, the flashback, well, it becomes a flashback scene, but we will find out where Raymond Shaw and his platoon were, and in this very stylized way, which is, I guess, the indication of that particular set of flashbacks. The other flashbacks are not handled in that way there, because they're more about what happened to Shaw after he gets out of the army.
Yeah, they're fairly straightforward.
Right. But first, we have to, as you mentioned before, we have to bring him home. He's been given the Medal of Honor for this allegedly heroic action that they took to take this gun emplacement. And of the 11 of them or 12 of them were there, two of them died, but the rest of them survived. And he comes home and there's fanfare.
And he single-handedly took out a whole platoon of Koreans.
Right.
And
And he's going to be, he was gone for a while. And when the war was over, he comes home and he's standing rigidly in his uniform at the top of the stairs coming off of a plane and looking at this fanfare. And there's his mother and his stepfather, who's a senator, and he's going to be decorated personally by the United States. And as you say, without need for exposition, we just learn very quickly, he does not have the best relationship with his mother. And as he will repeat many, many times, Johnny Islam is not my father.
Well, because they show up with this banner that just says Johnny Island's boy. It's like, I'm not his boy.
And the parents are played by Angela Lansbury, who is 3 years older than Lawrence Harvey. Lawrence Harvey at this point is like 34 years old. Angela Lansbury, 37. But Angela Lansbury was well into her playing mother's period. This is kind of the end of her movie career, really. She's about to become a Broadway star.
And holy cats, does it work? I mean, yes. It shouldn't work, but it works.
Yeah, absolutely. She's wonder. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. She was robbed. She should have won. It's as you will. And you don't know it early on how good her performance is. It's the kind of performance where, because she is so duplicitous as a character, who she is and how she interacts with all the other characters changes over time. And it's completely believable given what we learn about her. But if you think about it, there's like three or four different performances going on that she does in this movie.
And you are led down the garden path to think, oh, this is just an overbearing mother. This is just a political mover and fixer. And then near the end of the movie, when you get that turn of, oh, she's his handler too. You're like, oh.
It's kind of an onion, though, because you get she's the overbearing mother at this point, and she's involved in her husband's career. And it's apparent that she's the more dominant of the couple, but you don't know to what extent that's true.
Right.
And then a little later, when you see her having dinner with Johnny, her husband, played by James Gregory, it becomes apparent how dominant she is over him. And then the onion keeps unfurling further, and you learn more about what her role is. And as you say, at the very end, we get the most amazing scene that everybody always, if there's going to be a scene that is played for the Manchurian Candidate, is Angela Lansbury explaining what Raymond is about to do and why and what she knows about the situation. But we have a long way to go before we get
there. We'll get there, because there is one moment even right before that where I'm just like, that the first time I saw it, you're just like, oh, right. And it's just one line and you're like, oh yeah. I love a moment midway through where they're at the party and Johnny Iceland is, you know, well, you know, I wanted this. And she's like, no, just go and take this and drink in a corner. The grownups have to talk now. And it's just so beautifully done. Oh.
Angela Lansbury's husband is played by James Gregory, who TV audiences will know. You mentioned Barney Miller, which I had forgotten about. He was also in a lot of Westerns in the 60s, made some movies too. And he's got this gravelly voice. I, as I said before we got started, I don't think you see James Gregory playing a lot of love scenes. And you kind of think...
Not often, no.
Right. You kind of think he has the potential to be a villain. But what you learn is that he's the dupe, and Angela Lansbury is... the power behind the scenes and more than just an overbearing wife. She's controlling everything.
And one of the beautiful things that it did actually take me a few viewings to get this is that Johnny Island is just as much of a puppet as Raymond Shaw. Right? That is a fascinating balance. She's the one controlling both of them by the end. And But it's a great turn for him because normally, you expect him to be the villain. He is the bad guy. He's a great Star Trek villain in the first season of that. And this is just not what you expect.
Yeah, totally. And they're an interesting couple. And you don't, the one thing you don't learn, I don't guess it really matters, but you don't learn at what point Raymond Shaw's father died or became not part of the picture or whatever. Right. But the impression is that Angela Lansbury and James Gregory's characters have been married for a long time. Because when he was, before he was joining the army, which I guess is supposed to have been 8 or 10 years ago, they were together and he's been a senator for a long time. He was a senator at that time. So this is a long-term marriage where... Lawrence Harvey's character has always hated that guy, and he hates them as a couple. Like he and we'll talk about the book in a little bit that it's based on, but the impression that's always left is that Harvey can't stand either his mother or his stepfather. Although he's still in her thrall. I mean, he can't help the fact that he gets off the plane and there they are to greet him. He can't help that. But there are points in the movie where they summon him and he comes, and so clearly there's some sort of relationship there that he doesn't want to have but is having.
Right.
So then we move forward from this. We realize that this is not a happy relationship. Shaw seems very ambivalent about his military heroism, particularly in terms of like how his parents are treating it. But I think just in general, I think he wants to get on with his life. We find out very quickly that Johnny Iceland, the senator, is a McCarthy type character because he's very anti-communist. And the first thing we learn from Shaw is that he's going to get a job with one of their nemeses, who is, I guess, a liberal, if not communist, at least a very liberal journalist in New York. And that seems designed to piss his mom and stepfather off as much as anything. And so that's what he does. He's going off to New York to pursue this. And very soon, we're also going to meet. Apparently, we are doing plot. Apparently, that's what I'm doing.
Well, it makes sense to lead into it with some plot, just to give that basis.
Well, let's talk about that. So now we're close to where we're going to see flashbacks.
Because this is my favorite part.
Yeah, because both Frank Sinatra, who is the commanding officer of this group in Korea, we find out that he's having bad dreams, or has a very vivid nightmare about something that doesn't make sense to him. And we're going to find out that there are other people in this patrol that had nightmares. So why don't you just kick it? Why don't you talk about this really incredible flashback scene and all of the twists and turns that we go through during it?
I mean, this is such a brilliantly designed sequence where we see Frank Sinatra. He's kind of restless. He's sleeping and he's having this dream. And when we start into the dream, he's in a greenhouse with these lovely ladies talking about orchids and hibiscus and hydrangea and, you know, and so that's the first WTF moment of why is that making him upset? And, you know, as the camera kind of moves around, the camera is so fluid through this whole sequence. It moves around to show the lecture, and we see all these women all around, and we see members of the platoon are just sitting there and they're smoking and they're kind of slumped down. They don't look really engaged. And as the camera moves around, suddenly the woman is replaced by Kai Day, who is probably most famous as Wo Fat from the original Hawaii Five-O. And I insist that no matter what his name is in this, it's Wo Fat. He's just Wo Fat. It's fine. And throughout this sequence, as the camera's moving around, some of the cuts are pretty seamless. Some of it is literally from just, you know, as the camera's moving, someone moves into the place and takes over the speaking. Some of it is actually cutting because they change the set in parts of it. But it becomes clear very quickly that Kai Day is the one giving this lecture, and he's talking about just how quickly they brainwashed the entire platoon to an audience, not of little wonderful ladies in their hats and their dresses, but to red Chinese and Russian agents in a little operating theater. And he calls forward Raymond Shaw, and Shaw is sitting there miming something. He's doing something with his hands, which is a phrase that comes back. And we don't understand why. And as he's doing this, now the dialogue just sort of oscillates between talking about the flowers and talking about the brainwashing and talking about the flowers. And it is a very modern style of storytelling and shooting this sequence. It doesn't go overboard with exposition. You have to pay enough attention to it to figure out what's going on. But it is so seamlessly edited and shot and fluidly choreographed. And as part of this sequence, Kai Day explains that, you know, it is often said that the hypnotized subject cannot do something against their will, but we can prove that that's wrong. And, you know, here we have someone and we're going to see him kill someone. And so he tells Raymond, as part of this, to strangle Ed. Ed is one of his platoon mates. Ed is one of the platoon mates that we know has died, thanks to the earlier narration. And this is where we see that, no, it wasn't the Korean army that killed him. It's Raymond Shaw strangling him to death. And he shoots another one of the platoon members, which we discover later. And now, and the whole time, you know, Frank Sinatra's character is sitting there, and all of the platoon members are just completely passive, as if they have no idea where they are or what's going on.
Including the guys that get killed because they give Raymond Shaw the scarf that he's going to strangle Ed with. He speaks to Ed. He walks behind Ed. "Hey, Sergeant, what you doing?" And he strangles him, and he loses breath. And then at the last moment, there's a close-up, and he screams, which I guess is the point at which the hypnosis was broken for the victim. But then, of course, that happens, and there's no reaction except pleasure from the people who are watching the brainwashing.
Yeah.
And so all of it is, you're right, the editing is beautiful. The setting is beautiful because there's so much white in the room. There's so much, it's a little off-putting, the sort of way the people are arranged. Obviously they switch from, you know, who is who. The group of people that are watching the brainwashing are a very interesting group. I kind of wanted to know more about them because they didn't, it could have just been like five guys in suits with scowls on their faces, but it's actually a really sort of interesting, eclectic group of people. And even though you're given all the information about what's happening, you're still sort, it's still very off-putting and like, wait, is this a dream? Are we having a dream? And because it's a dream, is it not to be believed in terms of, you know, the realities of what's happening, especially since people are changing from, you know, Miss Emily Baldwin to Kai Day. <It's> like...
and one of the smartest things in the scene, especially considering, like if you've seen any of the marketing materials or any of the things, you will see the Queen of Diamonds plays a very important part in this movie. Just the playing card. And in this sequence, we don't see any playing cards, and we don't really, you know, unless you've seen the movie, you don't really know what Shaw is doing with his hands while he's sitting there. He's miming something. And the playing cards are part of the trigger. It's part of the post-hypnotic suggestion that we will learn that there is a trigger phrase. Why don't you go and play some solitaire? And the person will then just take out a deck of cards and start playing until they see the Queen of Diamonds. And the Queen of Diamonds is the trigger to make them susceptible to the instructions. So that's when they get their instructions. And once you know that, when you watch the movie again and you see him doing that, you're like, oh, well, that's what he's doing. But later in the film, as Sinatra's character is trying to figure out what's going on, and he says, what was he doing with his hands? That's part of trying to piece together what happened. And again, it's so smartly done. This might be one of my favorite movies we've ever done on this.
It creates that distraction because you're wondering what he's doing with his hands, which I think takes a little part of your, because there's so much going on in that scene that your brain has trouble figuring out what should I be focusing on. And it is one of those movies that when you see it the second and third and fourth time, you're going to understand things in a different way and you're going to appreciate how well it was put together.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it is very much like a good Columbo episode where you think you've gotten all the details and you're still learning details through the whole story. You don't have the complete solution until the end.
Right. But you don't have questions. It's not one of those bad detective movies where like, wait, how can this, it's not implausible. You're allowing it to carry you along.
Yeah.
So we find out that, so Sinatra, who is an Army intelligence officer now, is having this nightmare, and he goes and he tells his superiors about it. And they're skeptical. Eventually, he's going to get booted to a less advantageous position in the Army because people think he's kind of, maybe you're having some bad effects from the...
He's cracking up.
He's cracking up.
You're having what we don't know yet is called PTSD.
Right. But we also find out that another soldier who only has one scene, and I mentioned this because I want to talk about James Edwards a little bit. So James Edwards is a black actor who had been making very small and medium-sized roles in parts for, who had been playing small and medium-sized roles in movies for, you know, 10 years or so, and so got probably more opportunities than a lot of black actors at the time. I was astonished in this movie because he has one scene, he has this nightmare, and he wakes up and his wife is with him and she's telling him, you know, he's telling her what is going on. And I'm astonished by how terrible he is in that scene because he's a good actor. And I'm like, well, I gave you one scene. I don't, maybe they didn't give him time to pray. I don't know, but he's just really over the top and dramatic. Yeah. And I was like, yeah. What? That, I had to look at it. Was that really James Edward? Because he's a decent actor.
I think it might have just been, hey, can you outdo Sinatra's panic in his dream? Because like, oh, we need a jolt right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Sinatra since he's now part of the movie. And I think, David, you and I share a little bit of ambivalence toward Frank Sinatra in general.
I guess we have to talk about him.
I guess so. He's kind of one of the producers of the movie. He's kind of got first billing, you know.
You know, and being the producer, half the budget went to his salary.
Right.
Good job, Frank.
Well, this is the period when he is also at his most Frank Sinatra in terms of, he was in a lot of movies, and in terms of not only his biggest celebrity, but being a jerk face when he was in movies and just doing stuff that annoyed the hell out of other people that he was working with. And I don't have any Manchurian Candidate specific stories, although I'm sure there are some,
but I just have to
put that into the lexicon.
Yeah, you would think because there are so many examples, but maybe it was that he really liked this movie and Frankenheimer knew how to deal with him. I don't know, but I have not heard a lot about him misbehaving on this or anything. But yeah, I'm just not really a fan of Frank in general. And the fact that I love him in this probably says a lot about this movie. Yeah, it is irritating. And I think part of it is that in almost every movie, Frank Sinatra is a guy who's in control. He's the toughest, smartest guy in the room. And, you know, if there's anything in his way, he's going to knock through it like a bull in a china shop, right? That's Frank Sinatra. And in this movie, he starts out as a broken man. He is out of control. He's confused. He's lost. And he's trying to figure out why he is so screwed up. And he realizes that it's not just that he's screwed up. It's, you know, or that it was just the war, right? There is a specific particular reason why he's broken. And that is, it's an interesting note to play, but it makes an interesting character that he almost never played in anything else.
Right. And his performance is really low key without being too low key. I think the notes he strikes are just right. I think there are a couple of other movies where he approaches that level of quality of performance. The performances are different. But in this movie, you're right. He starts as a broken man. It's clear, though, that as he puts pieces together and realizes it's not just something in his imagination, and he has to get his superiors on board. He's a career military officer, so he has contacts. Even after he's sort of literally booted out of the army, he has the ability to go back and talk to people who will listen to him on some level. And I believe that in terms of the character. They give him a random love interest later in the movie, and at first I was like, why do they do that? And then I realized, because he needs somebody to talk to. But yeah, he's very good in this movie, but he's not. And I think if you didn't know the names, like if you just watched the movie, you would assume that Lawrence Harvey had top billing. And obviously billing doesn't always mean amount of screen time on the screen. But Sinatra's performance is sufficiently low key that you could believe it's just somebody who, you know, was hired to play that second lead part.
Yeah.
But he's managed to control his Frank Sinatra pretty well.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And, you know, that's why he vexes me, because he's got talent and he coasted a lot, you know, in a lot of his movies. It's just like, hey, I'm Frank. Right. And, you know, fine. OK, you've got charisma. Sure. But are you really serving the movie? In this, he serves the story. And it's kind of fun to watch that.
Yeah. Which is, again, super annoying.
And, you know, now the one thing I do know about him, because he did this on every movie, he didn't like to rehearse. And the longer you did a scene, the more times you did a scene, the less engaged he would be. And he would just be like, oh, we've done this 10 times. You know? And so there's a scene late in the movie where the first time they did it, he was crackling and he's out of focus in a lot of the shots. And so he's kind of moving in and out of focus. And Frankenheimer was like, well, all right, we got to shoot it again. But he wasn't as good. Well, let's try it again. He wasn't as good. All the ones where he's not good, he's in crystal clear focus. And Frankenheimer said, you know what? I'm just going to leave that one in because that's the best take I'm going to get out of him because he's lazy. And everyone praised it because they're like, oh, that it's like we're seeing Frank through Raymond Shaw's eyes. And so he's
art.
Going in and out of focus and it's intentional.
Because his reputation, one of the things he tended to do on movie sets was not be very generous with other actors. He was lazy. He only did one or two takes. And a lot of times when an actor had a close up or a scene where they're just speaking, you know, you don't always have the other actor right there with you. Sometimes they do it over a coat hanger. But Sinatra was particularly unlikely to be generous with other actors. And he's, even with people he admired, like there's a movie, which is not a particularly good movie, the movie called Devil at 4 o'clock that he did with Spencer Tracy in 1961. And so Tracy by this time is this sort of old, they do it in Hawaii. He's this sort of old, sick guy, and he's the lead. And Sinatra is being his young punk self. He is definitely playing the Frank. He's a convict at this point. But he just would notoriously not show up when Tracy had to do close-ups and had to do scenes. And he allegedly said he admired Tracy quite a bit. And in fact, in retrospect, Sinatra has like said glowing things about Tracy. But apparently he was really a jerk as far as, you know, and especially, like I say, Tracy is sick. He's kind of having trouble, you know, maintaining a long shooting schedule himself, and Frank Sinatra would just like some days not show up or show up at 4.
Yeah.
And sometimes he might be drunk or whatever. So, he's
Frank's on a bender.
Well, but we should talk about Henry Silva, though, because I found him interesting, too. So Henry Silva comes and he introduces himself to Raymond Shaw as somebody who was an interpreter, a guide for them in Korea, and he's so unmemorable to the Raymond Shaw character. The Raymond Shaw doesn't know. I guess I'll take your word for it. I mean, basically, he could have said all you guys look alike if he had wanted to. But he gives a story about how he's come to the United States and he wants to make good, but he needs a job. And so he's going to be Raymond Shaw's houseboy now. And of course, Raymond Shaw, who I don't know what, I mean, as a part of a political family, I assume there's money there. Raymond Shaw gives the impression that he doesn't need money, but he seems to be very good at creating stuff for the servants to do right away. He's like, I'm going to Washington, have my dinner ready by 8:30. It's like, okay, all right, we're back to Chinese houseboys and stuff. And of course, this guy is a mole for the, he's there to keep an eye on Raymond Shaw as part of the whole plot. And then when Frank Sinatra meets him, because he comes in contact with, he goes to find Raymond Shaw. And
well, he's told to go on leave. Right.
That's not a suggestion.
That's an order. And he goes, well,
you got to go. Permanent, indefinite leave, they say.
Instead of going off to a beach with a girl, he's going to go visit the guy in his dream.
And then when he comes to New York to see Raymond Shaw, instead of seeing Raymond Shaw, he sees, again, I'm going to mix the character names and that's just a thing we do on LTS. I'm not even going to apologize for it anymore. He meets Henry Silva and they have a fight.
And it is. I was saying this before. It is simultaneously a really effective, really gripping fight scene. It is also a really sloppily choreographed, clumsy fight scene. It's really weird. But
punches are sort of thrown wildly and they're very loud. Of course, that's Foley stuff, but it's...
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you go with the emotion of it. The emotion of the fight scene works beautifully. If you look too closely at the movements, it's okay.
But there's kind of no payoff for it. Well, there is in the sense of the plot, because the fight scene happens and Frank Sinatra gets arrested. I forgot where he met his girlfriend. See, this is why I don't do plots, because I always forget things.
So they met on the train as he's going up to New York. And she's actually quite sensitive to, you know, listening to his story, because he's not in a good place. And so she gives him her number and says, when you get to New York, call me. Here's my number. Just call me. And so when he gets arrested and she comes and picks him up, she's like, that was awfully sweet of you to have the police to call me. I did not expect that. It's a meet cute.
Yes, it's a very cute. And the one thing I'll go back on the train ride and say, it's the quietest train ever. I'm so used to any movie train scene where the putt, putt, putt of the train tracks is really loud. You can hear it if you really listen. But there's a point where I think they're standing in some sort of soundproof phone booth or something, because it's just super quiet and they're having this conversation.
I think it's supposed to be in the little vestibule between cars.
Which should
be even louder. Yeah.
Right.
I've ridden on trains. I know that.
Exactly. So that is how, from a plot point of view, we get out of the scene where he's beaten up on Henry Silva, and there's apparently no consequences, and there's no real follow through on that part of the plot. Like,
now that he knows
that Henry Silva is from the past, does Frank Sinatra not have any concerns about him? Does he sort of look up who he is, what his connection to this might be? There's no real follow-through. In fact, what's the point of the fight scene, except for him to meet cute with his new girlfriend?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it piques his curiosity, but then maybe he plays it a little too subtly, getting, you know, cozying up to Shaw and being like, well, you know, yeah, I beat up your houseboy, but let's have drinks. It's a little odd.
It is odd because they start out and clearly Shaw doesn't like anybody and nobody likes Shaw. So it's not like they meet and they're old army buddies and they're going to have drinks right away. Later in the movie, they get to be kind of friends, and they do have that scene we talked about before where Shaw is drunk and does some exposition. But for the moment, It's going to be fairly difficult for Frank Sinatra to ingratiate himself, it seems like, because he has to talk to Shaw and find out if Shaw is having any of these experiences that Sinatra remembers, you know, from his dreams. Once this progresses a little bit and Ben, who's Sinatra's character, is on Shaw's trail, I also wonder, why is he the only guy? It's just him. There's nobody.
Right.
You'd think that they would put an agent or two on Shaw at all times, because later on there's a point in the movie where, like, Shaw is out of pocket, and I'm like, why isn't there anybody following him?
Yeah. Yeah. That's where, having watched tons of these movies or plotted stories like this, where we kind of go, oh, yeah. No, they wouldn't do it that way. It wouldn't just be one guy.
So here in the middle of the movie, we're learning a little bit about the manifestation of the brainwashing. We're going to get the solitaire fairly right here, because that is the trigger, as you mentioned before, when somebody says, why don't you pass the time with a game of solitaire? And Shaw plays solitaire, and when he sees the Red Queen, then he takes the action that his minder tells him to take.
And again, it's like we have Chekhov's brainwashing early on, where, you know, he does it and then he gets the phone call, and the phone call tells him, you're going to go to the doctor on Friday for a checkup, and he hangs up. And then somewhere in here, I think, is when he's going to meet Frank Sinatra at a bar. And while he's waiting, some guys, the bartender, is just talking and he's doing this thing. He's like, yeah, you should occupy yourself. Why don't you go play a game of solitaire? And he immediately, you know, changes his manner and asks for a deck of cards. And so he's playing the cards as Sinatra enters. And just at that point, the bartender says, yeah, and I told him, why don't you go get a cab, drive up to Central Park and jump in a lake? And Shaw immediately puts down the cards and turns and leaves. And Sinatra's like, what the hell is going on? But he's seen enough to see the cards, and he realizes that's what Shaw was doing with his hands, and he sees the freezing on the Queen of Diamonds, and he realizes, I got to chase him. I got to go get him. And sure enough, he gets in a cab. He drives up to Central Park. He jumps in a lake, and Sinatra pulls him out of the lake and says, do you know that you just jumped in a lake? He's like, no, how did I get here? What am I doing here?
Yeah, and it's the whole thing, and explained that way, and as you watch the scene, there's a way in which that could be incredibly ridiculous, and you would just laugh at it and think, that what is that even? But the way they write the bartender's dialogue, I like it. I bought into it. I allowed you know, because it is hokey and it's ridiculous, but it works, I think, for a couple of reasons. I think the performance of the bartender, the actor as the bartender, I just think that actually helps, because I believe him when he's on the phone and he's talking to somebody away from, he's not talking to Raymond, he's just talking to this guy on the phone. And because I believe him, when he says the exact right set of phrases, it works. And then because Sinatra had enough, you could tell his reaction to the cards was specific enough and knowledgeable enough that it makes sense that Sinatra would follow him instead of saying, wow, I was supposed to meet him and he just left.
Right.
And that's the point at which Shaw has to confront what's going on. Because up until then, Frank Sinatra has a pretty good idea of there's something because he's got enough information. But Shaw, that's the first point at which the Shaw character is confronted with it. Because by this time, since he's been in the United States, when he goes to has this alleged car accident and they put him in this sanatorium for a little while to hide, his minders want to check him out because they haven't been in contact with him for a while. They, as a test, get him to kill his boss in New York. He just shows up and shoots the guy. And presumably, there's no question of him not getting away, because I guess he does. He comes and he kills him at 4 a.m. and he goes away and it's never spoken of again. But Shaw's basically like, oh, my boss is dead. That's kind of a bummer. He, of course, doesn't remember he did it. So this scene in the lake is the first point at which Shaw has to confront. This is kind of what. So now Frank Sinatra knows that he's going to have to get the information out. What does Shaw know? What does he remember? What can he tell about not only what he's programmed to do, but what the methods are and what all the triggers?
Right. And it's a beautiful illustration of how it works. It's a lovely use of location. Again, they went and shot in Central Park, although it's hilarious because he runs out, he pulls him out of the lake. And immediately when they go to the close-up shots of the two of them, it is very clear that they're being shot in a studio.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It's a little weird. Takes me out every time. But, yeah. Just go with it. It's fine.
And I guess there are reasons for doing it.
Yeah, no, he's beginning to piece these things together.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the concept of being a sleeper agent was very well known at the time. Certainly by the time I saw it, sleeper agent was a plot, right? It's, you have all these movies and books that use that. And even though they don't use that phrase in the movie, that's what Shaw is. And Sinatra is figuring it out.
I think it feeds into the paranoia that existed in general, because you've been through the McCarthy period. Now you're in the Cold War, Cuban Missile Crisis, Bay of Pigs, all that kind of stuff is happening. And I did not know this, but Dr. No was released within a few weeks. So James Bond is now extant in the universe. So there's not only sort of spies and thrillers in general, but all the paranoia that real life events are adding to the world as we see it in this time. But yeah, I don't know if sleeper agents were a thing that we've seen before, but I think the audience is kind of primed to go, oh, that could happen.
Right, right.
So Frank and Lawrence Harvey are going to hang out and they're going to have some drinks together. And it's not clear to me whether Frank he's presumably not drinking as much as Lawrence Harvey, because he lets Lawrence Harvey get drunk so that he can tell information. And I imagine, Frank is pouring his drink into the plants or something like that. But this is the point at which we learn that back before he went into the army, so presumably 8 or 10 years ago, he had this relationship with a woman who is the daughter of the enemy of Johnny Islam, his father-in-law, is his stepfather. And so Angela Lansbury and Johnny Islam straight up call this guy, Jordan, a communist. Whether he is or not, they're on opposite political sides. And so Raymond Shaw has this relationship with her. He doesn't know who she is, when they meet, but very quickly he finds out. And it is unclear whether when he explains who he is, whether Raymond Shaw's immediate decision to propose marriage to this woman has to do with the fact that he wants to stick it to his mother and stepfather, or whether he actually it's clear that he's attracted to her, but it's not clear after a day whether they're in love or not. And then,
it's a little abrupt.
Yes. And so he's told this story to Ben, his friend, but he says, and this is not explicated at all in the movie. Well, it is explicated. It's not shown at all in the movie. And then he basically says, so we had a really good summer together. It was wonderful. He basically says, you know what? I was a nice guy. I was lovable. Everything was great. And then my mom screwed it up on purpose. She wrecked it. And so that part he tells but doesn't show, which I think is fine, just given the length of the movie. Although it is the one scene that we were talking about where it feels like, oh, we're going to tell a story now, which is a little less interesting than if we were actually showing what happened.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a flashback within it. So we do go back. That's a sort of a straightforward flashback where he's telling the story, and then we see them there on the beach together, and they're having a great time, and then they go back, and this is when we meet Senator Jordan, her father, and he says, yeah, don't like your mom and stepfather very much, and he says, yeah, I'll marry your daughter, whatever. And then we come back to the present day, and that's where we find out that the mother ended this. And we need to know this for later because she's going to come back and with tragic results.
And a really convenient costume.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's like, oh, whose idea was that?
Yeah.
So
that one,
so now
that one is a little bit of plot convenience.
It's a little on the nose there. So Sinatra now has more information about Shaw's personal life and character. I don't know that he needed a lot of that for what goes forward, because he does learn what Shaw does and doesn't remember, but most of that story is about making this connection between his past relationship and when he's going to see this woman again, which is kind of not necessary to the plot if you think about it. Like, if you wanted to cut that out of the movie, you could have. I don't mind it. But as I think about it, I'm like, why do we need that other than to give him, I guess it's to give him some humanity, because ultimately what we're supposed to think of Shaw in the end is he's a pawn, even though he's an unlikable guy to begin with, for whatever reason. He's got this terrible relationship with his mother and his stepfather, but we're ultimately supposed to understand that he is a pawn of these people who are manipulating him to do terrible things.
Yeah. And this is a moment where we can kind of like switch over to the book for a minute.
Yeah.
Because that relationship takes a little more center stage in the book, partly because, and this is something you couldn't do in a movie in 1962, there is it's not even a hint, there is an incestuous relationship with his mother. And so there's much more of a rivalry, jealousy between the mother and the daughter of the other senator. And so it is more important to the book plot. It is just kind of thrown in here, but it still does give him humanity. It gives him another reason to hate his mother. So, you know, it's there. It's paying fealty to the novel, but it's maybe not as artfully done as the rest of the movie.
Yeah, there are only two points in the movie that I think the idea that incest might be a part of it are even, you know, broached, and they're not. Like, you wouldn't know it unless you were looking for it, I guess.
Right.
But there's a point early on where they talk about, I say they because I can't remember who says it. I don't think it's Lawrence Harvey. It's somebody else who talks about his love-hate relationship with his mother. And I'm like, I don't see any love. There's not any of that. Because the only interaction he has with her is, I hate you, or, yes, mother, I'll come and visit you. Because there's a point at which he goes to see them in Washington. There's a point later when she comes to his apartment. And my thought is, why are they even in the same room? I don't get it. Because he seems like somebody who would be quite capable of cutting off a relationship, but he seems unable to. And then later on at the party where there's a point at which they're all in costume, and the mother in costume comes to him and says, let's go and have a private drink together. And he goes off with her. And I just can't imagine that there would be any reason that would be interesting to him at all. He hates her guts. She's thrown this party for him, but she's promised him something that he very much wants in order to get him to come. And it doesn't work out for Angela Lansbury because of an unfortunate costuming choice.
And it's lovely in that moment because she does. And this is the line. This is the turn where she gets him alone and says, why don't we sit down and play a game of solitaire? And you go, oh, she's not just an evil mother. She's part of the plot.
She's part of the plot. Because you don't, you know she's evil before, but you don't know. You have no idea. You have no idea.
Yeah, you just think it's coincidental evil. And so he's doing the solitaire and he gets to the Queen of Diamonds. And then she's interrupted. And so she takes the cards and says, we don't want any shenanigans to happen, or something like that. Where it's like, you know, and she knows something accidental can happen when he's in the
state, in the susceptible
state.
So let's back up really quickly just to say, so he's had this relationship a long time ago. And then at some point, Angela Lansbury's character, Eleanor gets the idea that it's time for Raymond Shaw to be married. She never really explains why. It's her idea. And she says, you know we do understand why later on, but it's unclear at the time. So she says, you know, when he was involved with Eleanor Jordan, I think we should bring them back together. So I'm going to throw a big party and he's going to marry her. And you're like, why? She's the daughter of your enemy. And then there's another thing I think is a little sort of ham-handed and on the nose, because she meets up with the senator who is her husband's enemy, and basically says, I'm going to put my husband up for vice presidential nomination. Are you going to block me? And he goes, not only am I going to block you, I'm going to block, triple block you.
Yeah.
And which could have been predicted, even though by this point, you know, presumably she's setting it up so that they can be family. So this is the party at which Angela Lansbury takes Lawrence Harvey off to play solitaire and then takes the queen. And that is the point where the unexpected thing happens.
Right.
Because Jocelyn comes in and she's wearing a Queen of Hearts costume.
Queen of Diamonds.
Got, right, got right, to have your right. suit correct. And so that's the point at which they elope. They decide to get married. I don't know what.
Well, because she says, why don't we get married?
And he goes, of course, that seems like a good, which, to be fair, is probably the only suggestion he's gotten in the movie that he probably would have been okay with, whether he was hypnotized or not.
Right.
So now they're married, and which serves Eleanor's purposes, probably not exactly in the way she wanted to. But even though they eloped, it's apparently public knowledge because it's on TV fairly soon after. And they get married, and he is this is the point at right after they've gotten married. Frank Sinatra has decided something's about to happen. We need to take this guy out of action, and we need to make it impossible for him to do whatever it is he's supposed to do, because neither Shaw or Frank Sinatra know what he's been programmed to do, which is pretty smart. They're not giving him any heads up. You know, he doesn't know. All he knows is he's when the time is right, they're going to activate him. And Frank Sinatra is now back in full military uniform, and he comes to arrest, he says, Raymond Shaw, and he meets up with Josie, his wife. He meets up with both of them, and Raymond Shaw leaves for a little bit, but he says to her, look, I gotta take him away because something weird's going on. I'm not going to explain it to you because I can't, but I'm going to take him. And she goes, can I have 48 hours? Or he gives her 48 hours, which seems weird. And this is the point at which
I'm
like,
honeymoon.
Why is there nobody watching them then yeah. and after, and even to the point where later on he goes to the family home where she lives with her father. Nobody's watching him. Of course, it's immediately known that he, so he goes in, he's been given the instruction once he finds out that, once Angela Lansbury finds out that there's no way Jordan is going to help Johnny become vice president, which is what Johnny wants. She basically says, I'm going to have Raymond go kill Senator Jordan, which he does. But Josie sees, and he kills her. And it is that murder, unlike the previous murder where he kills his boss, apparently they immediately know that he did it. So I don't know what detectives we have working on this case.
I mean, Sinatra knows he did it.
Yeah, of course.
But nobody else seems to grasp that. It's not in the papers, although, again, we see a very nicely displayed newspaper highlighting it. He knows it is, but he can't just say that because where's the proof? There's no proof.
Because nobody was following him.
That's right. it's again a little plot convenience. I seem to recall the book is a little more complicated. It's been so long since I read it. This does kind of feel like we got to get to the end of the movie. Come on.
Yeah, it's true because things are moving quickly at this point. He goes into hiding, Raymond Shaw does, but he calls Sinatra, and they basically, at this point, the cards are going to be laid on the table. The political convention
literally.
Is coming up, and literally, yes. and we learn that Shaw's job is to, and this is the great thing about the diabolical nature of what he's been asked to do is that even explaining it makes a great scene. It's not just, here's this crazy thing, and here's what's going to happen when Angela. This is the great scene that Angela Lansbury has, where she's explaining in far more detail than is actually necessary for Raymond Shaw's knowledge. And she's explaining what he's asked to do. She's doing the part in the detective story where you tell what actually happened.
Yep, she's monologuing that never goes well, and she says, basically the idea was to get Johnny Island picked as the vice presidential nominee and then to assassinate the presidential nominee at the convention so that all the sympathy goes to Island. He gets elected and then he declares an authoritarian state that makes martial law look like a day in the park.
Which, such a good scene.
Wow.
I know.
And,
my God.
You know, you're just like, and that the other part of her planning is she knew that they were going to send her a sleeper agent, and she didn't know it was going to be her son. And as a result, once this is all done, she is going to get revenge on everyone who sent him to be the tool of this.
Or so she says.
Again, you're just like, oh, she's even more evil.
She's extra, all kinds of double, triple, evil squared.
This is not Jessica Fletcher.
Or even Mrs. Lovett. I mean.
Mrs. Potts, no! Right? They sent Chip to be my tool of assassination. Oh, they will rue the day. I will get you, Candelabra.
And I think the way it's shot, and she does monologue it. She absolutely does. Oh, but she is chewing zero scenery.
No, it's so good.
It's
That's
really good. I love the angle at which they shoot it, because they sort of shoot up and her head is at an angle for a good part. Because she's looking down at Raymond, who's in a chair, and there's the giant Queen of Diamonds right there, which is like, oh, that's really big. but she, I don't know, it's just beautifully filmed. She as an actor handles it so well. And it does help that she's doing 100% of the talking, because Raymond is in a hypnotic state at this point.
Yeah.
And he's just like, just give me the order. Just give me the command. And you barely, he's in a wingback chair. So you see the top of his head. You don't even see his face. So it's all, you know, for Angela Lansbury's benefit, it means there are no distractions. But she also handles it incredibly well.
And like the first time I saw this, and I didn't know beforehand what the Queen of Diamonds had to do with anything. But, you know, it was on a lot of the marketing materials. And there was part of it the first time I saw it, where I was like, they cast Angela Lansbury because she kind of resembles the Queen of Diamonds, right? It's a very similar look, right? She's got the same eyes. And one of the things I learned watching it for this time was that Frank, as the producer, wanted to hire Lucille Ball for that role.
That's messed up.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, yes, she could do drama. She did a very good movie called Stone Pillow about being a homeless woman late in
my career.
Quite a lot
later, like mid-70s,
and, you know, she could do it. She had the chops, but at this point in her career, it would have been laughed off the screen because, no, you can't do that.
She had done a movie called Lured that we talked about on Line of Stars and Shields 15 years ago as a much younger person. At this point, just to put Lucille Ball in context, at this point, she's doing comedies with Bob Hope when she's off of the successor to the I Love Lucy show. She's doing the first of the spinoffs. I think it was just called The Lucy Show.
The Lucy Show,
And I don't think American audiences, just looking at Lucy's face, never mind whether they had put a wig on her or something like that, I don't think they could have taken her seriously. It would have been an incredible challenge for any actor. And for Lucy Ball at this point in her career, it would have made zero sense. And I also don't think her chemistry with Harvey would have worked at all either.
No. And thank God Frankenheimer had worked with Angela Lansbury on a previous, like literally the last film he had made. And he said to Frank, watch this movie. I think this is Eleanor. And to his credit, he watched the movie and went, oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
She was perfect. I mean, I'm sure there are others who could have done it, but, she's not playing against established type, because she's toward the end of her sort of movie mother playing much older than she actually is era, and she was kind of getting sick of it. I think this is a great way for her to have gone out. She's nominated for Best Supporting Actress, and she's robbed. She should have won.
She won the Golden Globe for it.
I know she did.
And she should have won the Oscar.
She has all those Tonys to keep her warm later, but she was robbed, especially since she lost to the Miracle Worker. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Don't get me started. It's an amazing performance. And as I say, it contains some, I don't know, multitudes is probably too strong, but there's a lot in
layers.
Layers, yes, many layers. It's a great performance and so chilling. And because they withhold the point almost to this point, but you know by now that she's part of the plot, that she is the American handler, because they withhold it so long, you're like, what is her part in this? And you find out and you're just like gobsmacked. It's amazing.
Now, again, the focus on the Queen of Diamonds as a motif, just as a visual motif through the whole movie, that's one of the things everyone thinks about. The visual motif you never hear about is Lincoln.
Yes.
Almost every scene has Lincoln, right? Busts of Lincoln, paintings of Lincoln, you know, sketches of Lincoln. At the costume party, John Iseland is dressed as Lincoln. And, you know, in a movie about an assassination, you really don't want to dress as Lincoln. That's just that's just tempting fate. Not to spoil the end of the movie.
There's a lot of Lincoln in that movie. And yeah. I had forgotten that he's Lincoln in the costume party. And because I've seen it so many times and because I had just seen all those pictures of Lincoln, I just bust out laughing on those hilarious. It's like, oh, my God, and he just not particularly good looking. He doesn't look like a good Lincoln.
No. And now I will say at the costume party, he does the limbo. James Gregory is surprisingly limber.
More limber than you expect.
More limber than I am, I think. And he's got the stovepipe hat and he just sort of pops it up and over the bar and keeps going. And it's like, wow.
It actually looks like a fun party. I mean, it's actually kind of wild. There's a lot going on. They put a lot of money, and you're not in the party all that long because pretty soon you're going to take Raymond Shaw off to the library. But that party scene is pretty wild.
It looks fun. Yeah. And it's a nice moment of levity before the last act.
So now we're at the point at the political convention, which is the big thriller set piece. And we talked about a little bit before about how at first Frank Sinatra, he's waiting for Raymond Shaw to call because basically the instructions that he's been given are, all right, when you learn what they're going to do with you, call me and we'll move in and stop it. But Raymond never calls him. And you don't know at that time why. You don't know whether it's an intentional decision or whether Shaw has been successfully rehypnotized, because when he and Sinatra are together, he says basically, I'm going to pull the wires out, and they make some indication that it's been deactivated, but you don't know.
Because Sinatra has used a forced deck, what right. magicians would call a forced deck, where every card is the Queen of Diamonds, and he uses that to try and deprogram him. We don't know if it works.
We don't know if it works or not. We have no idea. And it helps that Harvey as Shaw is this laconic presence. There's nothing about the way he moves through the scene that
right.
gives you any indication as to what his motive might be, because he's just the same sort of, you know, stiff presence. He's a cipher. And he goes to this political convention. He's disguised as a priest. He's supposed to go up into this high area of the convention hall, into this booth, and he's supposed to fire a gun at the exact right moment at the presidential nominee so that Iseland can heroically pick up his body and then take over as vice presidential nominee and then become president. So here's my question. I don't think Iseland, through the movie, knows what Eleanor, his wife, is doing in detail. I think he's happy to be kept and ordered around, but I don't think he's part of the plot. So at what point does she tell him what's going to happen or how much of what's going to happen? Because she very explicitly says these are he's going to go and he's going to cradle the body of the guy who's been shot in his arms, and he's going to do this dramatic thing that is going to cause him to be elected president. And I guess I wonder how she prepared him for that.
Yeah. I think that's where there's more detail about it in the book. I think he knows enough to know that this is going to happen, but he doesn't know how involved she is, what she knows, or that she knows the assassin, let alone who the assassin is.
That seems plausible. There are all sorts of ways you could convey that information to him, probably.
Yeah.
And so we see it's the long dramatic scene where Raymond is up in the booth. He's got the sniper rifle. We see him loading the bullets one at a time in an excruciating fashion. He aims the bullet. I like the details, which is part of Lansbury's earlier scene, where she says, at this exact moment when these lines are being said, this is when you're going to shoot. And first she says the lines, and then he mumbles them back at her, which is a clue for the audience to help us realize, okay, this is the point at which the tension is going to grow higher. And again, we've got a television showing this guy giving the speech. He's in a white suit, and he's, you know, so he's easy to spot, and he's down there on the convention floor, and it's very well done, and it looks 1962. It really looks like what you would have seen, and very black and white, and very just sort of, because color is just coming into television at this point, never mind the film we're watching. And so you create this tension of this faraway figure saying the sentences before the sentences before the sentences at which he's actually going to get shot. And so Raymond aims his gun. And oh, and all this time, Frank Sinatra has somehow figured out, and they don't explain how, he somehow figured out where Raymond is, and we see him running up stairways and down hallways and trying to find him.
It's you know, he's figured out that he's heard the announcement that Iceland is going to be the vice presidential nominee, and he kind of pieces that together. He's like, oh, I bet I know what they're going to do on live TV. And then it's just figuring out what's the best angle. If I'm a sniper, where am I going to shoot from?
Yeah, I guess that's I understood why he knew that what was going to happen. But the figuring out the where part was not
right.
The part that seemed apparent right. to me. But yeah, he goes, and his trip up the stairs and down the hallways is made just long enough so that he doesn't get there until the moment after Raymond has fired the gun, and he doesn't kill the presidential candidate. He kills somebody else.
He kills Johnny Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And then his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And we go, oh, the deprogramming worked.
There you go.
Good job, Frank.
And and then Raymond kills himself, and the gunshot fades seamlessly into a clap of thunder. And Frank Sinatra is at home with his wife, who he's married, the girl who he's met cute. And they're together, and he's reading citations for Medal of Honor winners and how much bravery those Medal of Honor winners exercised and the heroic things that they did. And then Raymond Shaw led some guys out of, you know, of Korea or whatever. So the impression, and he's lamenting, and he's in despair over what happened to Raymond Shaw, and that his true heroism was in saving the country by shooting Islam and his mother, not by what he had allegedly done in Korea.
Yeah.
And that's
which
how
is,
we end.
Which is not in the book. That's a nice a nice scene, though.
How does the book end?
It just ends with Shaw turning the gun on himself.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, final thoughts, anything we didn't get to? We did so much plot this time.
We did a lot of plot. gosh. One thing I found interesting, it's obvious to look at Iceland and go, well, that's Joe McCarthy. But the character of Eleanor was specifically inspired by Roy Cohn, which, considering what we've learned about Roy Cohn since the 80s and since Angels in America, it's kind of funny to imagine him married to Joe McCarthy. It's like, oh, what did Richard Condon know there? That's kind of interesting. Again, not something you would necessarily put in a book or a film in 1962. But yeah, I did find that interesting. One thing I did learn this time around, because I went and did some research on the book, and I kind of need to go and do more research on this now because I'm curious about it. But apparently, some forensic linguists have decided that Richard Condon plagiarized segments of I, Claudius by Robert Graves.
Wow.
For the book. And I'm trying to figure out, how does that work? And, you know, is it straight up plagiarism, or is it just that, you know, it's inspired by Roman tragedies and, you know, evil mothers and assassinations? And, you know, I don't know. But having read both of the books at about the same time, it didn't occur to me. So, I don't know.
That's interesting. So the things
are kind of interesting. Yeah.
The random bibs and bobs I read about the book are that apparently right after it came out, it was Time Magazine called it one of the 10 best bad novels, whatever that means. So it criticizes it for being over the top. And I think they have some issues with some of the writing. They don't care about the thriller and the plot aspects of it. They actually see it, even because you're in the late 50s, so you're post-McCarthy, they see it as relevant, but it's pulp is what they basically say about it. And so that was interesting to me. And I my guess, too, is that the incest angle probably would have had some impact on that point of view. It's like, really? Really? You have to do this?
Yeah.
I can see them being grumpy about that.
Well, and between, you know, that and advising consent, and, you know, there is sort of this weird little period where you have these political thrillers that also sort of break some sexual taboos for the period.
That's true. And it's funny how small a period of time all of those political thrillers happen. And it's because the Cold War is longer than the 5 or so years that these movies were happening. This is like right in the middle of that period. You have Advice and Consent, and you have 7 Days in May, and The Best Man, and just a ton, Dr. Strangelove even. And there's just tons of these movies. And then it kind of went out of fashion for whatever reason. And you're right. I don't think women fare particularly well in most of these movies. I would argue that the best woman's role of all of them is Angela Lansbury,
yes,
the Manchurian Candidate.
Absolutely.
Because the other two women are sort of, you know, they're there so that the male characters can have somebody to talk to. Nothing, they're not badly written. I'm just saying they're not instrumental in the plot particularly.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I can't really remember any women in Failsafe or even Dr. Strangelove.
No.
Or, I mean, I guess there is some in
Advice. I think there's some in Advice. Well, there's one in Advice and Consent, maybe
yeah.
The Best Man. But
yeah,
not
these
very
are
many.
These are manly man movies.
Oh, yeah. Lots of dudes. Lots of dudes in all these movies. Well, David, thank you for being the lone survivor of the Manchurian Candidate LTS panel. The rest of them, they disappeared. No one knows what happened to them, but it was fun talking to you about nonetheless.
One of them I did tell to get in a cab and go to Central Park and jump in a lake. So, you know.
Could they swim? Did you check that out first?
I don't know. And I won't say who it is, but but if it's me and I'm actually using the GIF of TC turning to the camera and brushing his hands, that might give it away. Just a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. No shade on anybody who we might not be mentioning
now.
Not at all.
No.
Well, friends, in 2 weeks, we'll be back. Believe it or not, friends, it is almost the holiday season, and in 2 weeks, we'll be back with a very different movie. Remember the Night will be our offering for the holiday season, starring Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck. Most of the panelists of LTS, big Stanwyck fans, some of them not. They can close their ears. But we'll be talking about that movie for the holiday season. If you want to keep up with this show, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS. Follow, subscribe, read all the links. I've got a couple of good Manchurian Candidate links to lay on you, as well as you can go to Twitter. I mean, I guess you can. You don't have to, but you could. And you can follow us at Lion Tower Shield until I get the Mastodon account set up. Or you can just write us at lts@theincomparable.com. One way or another, you can find us, and Elon can't stop you. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye now.